This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Here's the conventional wisdom about the Republican presidential nomination this year and in many years past, that the race is about the establishment versus the insurgents, and that eventually the leading establishment candidate will have to move right to fend off an insurgent challenge. It's a neat, coherent, and often exciting story, but our guest today says it's also wrong. We're talking this hour with one of New Hampshire's leading political scholars, Dante Scala of UNH. In his new book, co-authored with Henry Olson, Scala says the GOP process of picking a nominee is far more nuanced than the insider versus outsider narrative. To really understand how it works, Scala says, you have to examine what he calls the four faces of Republican voters, who they are, where they are, and what their past successes and failures have been in selecting the party's standard bearer. That's what we're looking at today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dante Scala, welcome. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, how wrong is that conventional wisdom, Dante? Is it a lot wrong or just a little bit wrong? I mean, I have to say, I had a hard time getting my head around that there was nothing right in this establishment versus insurgent narrative that we hear all the time.
There's a kernel of truth there. But it's wrong enough to distort people's perceptions of how things are going to unfold next year. And a key thing to keep in mind is that, you know, there really is no such thing as an establishment candidate, but there are different flavors that kind of people tend to blend or meld together into that establishment candidate. But the whole dynamic that is laid out when we talk about an establishment versus an outsider, the establishment's got to move to the right and so forth, it's actually a much more complicated dance that we're going to see these candidates play out over the next several months in order to become the nominee of the party. And the shorthand, you know, take outsiders, for example. Like, everyone's been lumping Donald Trump, Ben Carson, Carly Fiorina together and saying, well, look, these are all outsiders. They've never been in government. And this is an example of how the Republican Party has become anti-establishment. But then you take a closer look at those three candidates. You look at Ben Carson. He's very clearly a candidate who appeals foremost to one of the faces, as we say, of the Republican Party, which is evangelical Christians, very conservative evangelicals. And then you look at Carly Fiorina, and arguably she's an insider's idea of what an outsider candidate would look like. She has never held office, but she is not particularly appealing to religious conservatives. But she could be very appealing to, say, a chamber of commerce, business-type Republican who cares about tax cuts and cutting government regulation. So two different people already. Then you throw Donald Trump into the mix, and arguably the most outsider of all, perhaps, but he appeals to a very different part of the Republican Party than either of the first two. And I think the closest analogy I've come up with is he's a 21st century version of Pat Buchanan. And so, but all these three are lumped in and the media call them outsiders. And that's the problem with the narrative, is that it becomes too simplistic and it covers up the nuances in the Republican Party, which the Republican Party is at a really interesting juncture right now. And the fact there are so many candidates and things are so up for grabs, the party typically has been known as the orderly party, right? Like Republicans always nominate the next candidate in line. And that was said about Bob Dole, and that was said about John McCain, that was said about Mitt Romney. Nowadays, there seems—
Who's next in line?
No one knows. And the Democrats were always blamed for having disorderly primaries. No one knows what those Democrats are going to do next. This cycle, we've seen that flip, that it's the Democrats we don't talk about so much because that race seems static. And Republicans, it's a free-for-all.
Let's talk about these four faces that you talk about, you and Henry Olson, in your book, Dante. And we definitely will, a little bit later in the hour, figure out where today's candidates fit into these four faces or four factions. But the cool thing about the book is it goes back at least 20 years. All the election cycles that I have covered here from 1996 onward. So just real quickly, Dante, and then we'll go into detail. What are the four faces of the Republican Party?
So the four faces of the Republican Party are, one, moderate and liberal voters. And we identify those people because that's how they identify themselves in exit polls. So our data for all this is all the exit polls that have been done of presidential primaries, you know, going back, as you said, about 15 years back to 2000. And in exit polls, those are the polls that people take of voters on their way out of the primary voting place. And so people are asked, well, how do you identify yourself? And so, including ideologically. So one group is moderates and liberals. Second group, somewhat conservative Republicans. And they, well, they're the unsung heroes of the story. And we'll talk more about why later. And then third, very conservative evangelicals. And then fourth, very conservative secular voters who aren't especially religious but are nonetheless self-identify as very conservative.
Let's talk about the bloc, actually, that you say is the most important. And as you just hinted, Dante, the most misunderstood. This is the group you call the somewhat conservatives. Not the flashiest name, but we'll stick with it. Why are they the most important?
Right. They are the least flashy, and they're the least likely to be interviewed by a national media person coming to New Hampshire. The media look for those voters. They look for the Trump voter. They look for the Ted Cruz voter. They might look for the John Kasich moderate voter. Some of conservatives are, in a word, boring. They're right in the middle of the party, but they're the glue of the party. They're definitely conservatives. Like, they would not describe themselves as moderates, let alone liberals. But they're conservative in two ways. They're conservative ideologically, but they're also conservative in terms of their mood and their disposition. So they're very skeptical of change for the sake of change. Now, that includes liberal change. So that would include Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders type of change. But they're also skeptical of very conservative candidates, i.e., say, a Ted Cruz, who talk about remaking the government. They're skeptical of that, too. So it's a moderate or somewhat type of conservatism. And they're the ones who are really right in the square in the middle of the Republican primary electorate. So the direction they go, the candidate they eventually back, ultimately winds up being the nominee.
Yeah, you say they always pick the winner, this group. So pay attention to them.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny in a way, Dante, that they're the most important. They're the glue of the party. They always pick the winner, and yet they're the least understood.
Yeah, and I had a hard time understanding them, and it was Henry who It was Henry who explained them to me when he said, think of John Boehner, you know, former Speaker John Boehner. What type of Republican is he? He's a reliable type of Republican, but an unexciting type of Republican. And he always drew the ire of those very conservative members of the House of Representatives who would say, look, you are not making change as fast as we would like. But John Boehner is very comfortable in that kind of country club, chamber of commerce, I'm a Republican, but I'm not a radical Republican type of person. And it's those people, when they decide where to go, who will determine the nominee, not the most outspoken conservatives.
So of the, I think it's four or five presidential nomination processes that you follow, Dante, who fits this somewhat conservative mold?
In 2012, for example, it was Mitt Romney. Okay. And it was Mitt Romney who was able to put together a coalition of voters that included moderate Republicans, but also it was somewhat conservative Republicans when they were confronted with a choice between Mitt Romney and, say, ultimately Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum, who said, okay, we're going to stick with Romney. He's more our type of conservative voter. And then if you go back to, say, 2000, it was actually George W. Bush who ultimately, not John McCain, who became the favorite of those somewhat conservative Republican voters.
We actually have a little bit of sound. We've gone back into our archives, Dante, finding some of these voices that you mentioned. Let's hear Texas Governor and then Republican presidential candidate George W. Bush in that sort of somewhat conservative mode that you mentioned, Dante. Here he is at an event in Nashua in 1999 talking about the need for tax cuts. Let's hear.
I know we need to get rid of the death tax in America and the earnings test for Social Security recipients. And I know we need to mitigate the marriage penalty. And that's my plan. It simplifies the tax code. But let me tell you what it does, and it's important for folks to hear. By cutting the marginal rates, it insures against an economic downturn. By cutting the marginal rates and giving people more money in their pocket, if our economy ever turns down, it's insurance policy against slow economic growth.
So that's Texas Governor and Republican presidential candidate George W. Bush, who obviously went on to win twice successfully, appealing to that core group that you talk about, Dante, somewhat conservative.
Yeah, and you listen how he framed the idea of tax cuts. At the time, he was running against a very conservative candidate named Steve Forbes, who was a self-funding candidate, came from a very wealthy publishing family and so forth. And Steve Forbes called for radical change in the tax code. You know, he was for flat taxes and things like that. So notice how Bush positioned himself and said, well, look, I want to cut taxes too, but we're going to do it around the margins. We're going to tweak it here. We're going to tweak it there. That's the type of incremental change, incremental conservative change that those somewhat conservative voters are comfortable with.
Let's hear from another person who also fits that category, Dante, the somewhat conservative. This is GOP presidential candidate Bob Dole. Here he is speaking at a GOP presidential primary debate in Manchester in 1996, talking about it's time for a Republican government from the president on down. Let's hear.
If you think about it, we're just one election away. Think about it. One election away from having a Republican president and a Republican Congress that share the same vision. Been a long, long time. And 1 year away probably from a balanced budget. We'd be on our way to a balanced budget. We'd be on our way to tax reform. Credits, tax credits for families with children. On our way to welfare reform. Putting our parents back in charge of school and untying the hands of the Justice Department and letting our courts and making certain we get good conservative judges on our courts. We'd have moral leadership in the White House.
Again, that's GOP presidential candidate Bob Dole way back in 1996. So there he is, Dante, kind of giving a laundry list, nothing too crazy or radical, but saying, yeah, I'm conservative and I'm for you.
Yeah, notice how Bob Dole, as you say, kind of runs the gamut of Republican policy positions and tries to reach out to all the different factions of the party. Notice also how often he used the term Republican. And that's another thing to keep in mind. These somewhat conservative voters identify as Republicans. And you might think, well, so what? They're Republican primary voters. Of course they do. Not compared to, say, moderates and liberals. Moderate and liberal Republican primary voters are much more ambivalent toward identifying as I'm a Republican versus the somewhat conservative people who say, I'm Republican and clear about it. Now, they're a little bit shy about the Tea Party. Compared to say
those. I was going
to
ask you about that, exactly. Where that fits in.
Yeah. I mean, liberal and moderate Republican primary voters are allergic to the Tea Party. They dislike them. But the somewhat conservative voters are, again, I take a middle position. They're supportive. About two-thirds were supportive of the Tea Party that we found in our exit poll data. But not nearly as strong as, say, those very conservative voters. So the somewhat conservatives were supportive, but kind of kept them at arm's length a bit. And, you know, you could think of that almost in terms of, you know, Senator Ayotte, for example. You know, someone who takes conservative positions, but no one would label her, well, her opponents might, but no one in the party would label her as a Tea Party conservative. and but somewhat conservative, kind of trying to keep that middle ground and appease all the different factions. And that's the interesting thing about primaries, we think, is how these different factions of the party, they all agree on whom they dislike. Like all these people we're talking about, these groups, they all dislike Hillary Clinton. They all dislike Bernie Sanders and what they stand for. But that doesn't mean that they're not at least somewhat skeptical, if not suspicious, of one another. So they're like a confederacy of tribes, so to speak. And they all agree on the common opponent, but they have difficulty agreeing amongst themselves and seeing themselves from the other's point of view.
One other question about this group. Again, the most important group, as you say in your analysis, Dante, the somewhat conservatives, they are based all over the country. I mean, with some of these other groups, you know, they're stronger in New Hampshire or they're stronger in the South or whatever. But with this group, the somewhat conservatives, they're everywhere and they're big everywhere.
Yeah, we were able to access the exit poll data, look at these groups state by state. And what's striking is they're always there. And maybe that's why they're taken for granted, because they're like the wallpaper. I mean, they're always in every region, just about the same amount, you know, 30-35% of these Republican primary voters are somewhat conservative. Whereas, as you mentioned, you know, other like evangelicals, very regionally concentrated, moderates and liberals more northeast. But somewhat conservatives are just always present, always influencing, and usually always ignored.
The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. Dante Scala is an associate professor of political science at UNH. We're talking about his new book that he co-authored with Henry Olson, looking at the four factions that have defined the GOP presidential nomination process. You can join us too at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Dante, did you want to jump back in there?
Yeah, I guess the one thing, what's interesting is that the exit polls will often ask voters what qualities they would like to see in their nominee. And I think probably what describes the wishes of the somewhat conservatives is they want to find a candidate who's reliable. And a Bob Dole fits that to a T. You know, back in 1996, remember, it was a three-person race, ultimately, between Bob Dole, Lamar Alexander, and Pat Buchanan. And then Alexander loses New Hampshire, Buchanan wins, and then it becomes Buchanan versus Dole. And when somewhat conservative voters had to choose between a fire breather like Pat Buchanan, who wanted to upset the apple cart, and Bob Dole, who was as reliably Republican as it could be, it was a clear choice for them.
So, Dante, here's an email, and this gets to the geography that you were just touching on. This is from Christopher in Manchester. Thank you, Christopher. He says, I appreciate Dante's study, and I would assert there are also various shades of Democrats, despite the simplification of both parties in daily media. Could Dante also discuss the regional differences in the Republican Party in the country and some issues which divide the party regionally? Thank you, Christopher, for the email. And Dante, let's do that, because it's not just who these four faces are, but where they are.
You're right. Okay. So moderate and liberal Republican primary voters, they're regionally concentrated in the Northeast, including here in New Hampshire. And New Hampshire, and the fact that we have the first in the nation primary, gives those moderate and liberal Republican primary voters, even though they're often thought of as on the margins of the party, an unexpected amount of influence and strength, because New Hampshire tends to choose who the so-called moderate candidate is going to be, like the champion of the moderates. And then that champion advances out of New Hampshire. And the key to New Hampshire is if that moderate wins, he becomes a household name overnight. And then moderates all over the country realize, oh, that's our person. That's who we're going to vote for when we have a chance. So that's moderates and liberals.
Northeast.
Northeast. Very conservative evangelicals you find typically in the South, okay, really the bedrock of the Republican Party. They're most concentrated there. We also find them, of course, they're a great presence in the caucus state of Iowa. Okay. But much less so in the Northeast. Somewhat conservatives, as we mentioned, find them everywhere. Very conservative seculars are interesting because they tend to be the most urbane and the most urban of these four groups. And we think that's one reason, like they tend to live in cities like Washington, D.C., Boston, New York City. They're conservatives, but they like the sophisticated life of urban America. And so we say that we think that's why the DC media focuses so much on that particular group and attributes all sorts of influence to them, because everyone in the DC media, political media, knows a very conservative secular who's probably working for a think tank or something like that.
Yeah, a think tank or some news outlet, or maybe worked for a conservative congressman on Capitol Hill or a conservative White House. Well, what's interesting about this regional question, Dante, and you mentioned this in the book, is that the four faces happen to line up perfectly with the four early nominating states. So how so?
Okay, so Iowa, as we mentioned, very conservative evangelicals.
Those are your religious voters.
Right. And the whoever emerges out of Iowa as the winner typically does so because they have the support of that particular group. So Iowa crowns the champion of very conservative evangelicals. New Hampshire, as we mentioned, tends to crown someone who's going to be the champion of the moderate and liberal voters. South Carolina, somewhat conservatives. Okay, they go third on the list, and South Carolina tends to be a place where somewhat conservatives weigh in with who their champion is. And then Nevada is the Nevada caucus is actually a place where you see very conservative seculars have more influence than they do elsewhere, in part, large part, because of the caucus format.
Is that by design, or is that just amazing happenstance? Because when I got to that point, I went, wow, that fits.
It does fit by.
It kind of makes it easy, right? Four early states, four faces of the party. Each one, you know, elects a champion for that faction.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know that the party leadership had this in mind. So I'm inclined to say it's just kind of the way it's fallen out over time. But it is interesting how they each. I mean, if New Hampshire voted later and there wasn't a northeastern state up front, those moderate primary voters would have, I would think, much less influence than they do. And that's kind of one of the striking things, is that in the conservative party, it's been the champion of moderates the last couple of cycles, John McCain, Mitt Romney, who's emerged as the nominee. The conservative party rarely nominates, if ever, the most conservative candidate. They typically go for someone much less conservative.
That somewhat conservative group that you talked about. Yeah, that sort of number two group if you're going down the scale from moderate to conservative and so forth. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Dante Scala is here. He's an associate professor of political science at UNH and a fellow at the Carsey Institute. We're talking about the brand new book that he co-authored. It's called The Four Faces of the Republican Party. Dante, last thoughts on this issue of, you know, again, it's kind of interesting that there are four faces and four early states and each face fits into a state.
Yeah. Christopher asked about an issue that divides these four faces.
Sure, and our emailer,
And one that we come up with again is the issue of abortion, on which, you know, we usually think of Republicans as united, but in fact, they're not on that issue. They hold a variety of positions.
All right, more with Dante Scala after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the four faces of the Republican Party. In a new book, political scholar Dante Scala and his co-author Henry Olson look at the four factions that have defined the GOP presidential nomination process, a process that Scala says is misunderstood and misinterpreted by the media and the so-called conventional wisdom. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. By the way, those four faces that Dante talks about are the moderates and liberals, the somewhat conservatives, the very conservative and secular, and the very conservative and religious. Give us your questions and comments on these four faces of the party, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dante, we've got a call. Johanna's calling in from Vermont, Jacksonville, Vermont. Hi, Johanna. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. I'm calling primarily because it seems to be that the media uses these words, moderate, conservative, liberal, and they never focus on the party platform. For years, I was an independent, and then I realized that I might as well be a Democrat because I could never vote for a Republican because of the party platform. And that seems to be lost in conversation. We overuse these terms.
Well, Johanna, thank you. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. She talked about the party platform. That's part of the process at the end of the process, right? They come together at the convention, and these four faces have to create a platform that everybody can agree on. After reading your book, Dante, I'm thinking, that's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, and it's something that the platform might be something where you find the more ideological, the more conservative activists playing a part in forming the platform, whereas the candidate, the nominee, you know, does the nominee sign off on the party platform? Yes. But does the nominee emphasize all parts of the party platform equally? The answer to that is no. And what's interesting about the four faces is not that they take wildly varying positions on issues, but their issue priorities are significantly different. And by that I mean, you know, in exit polls, voters will be asked, what issue was most important to you in making up your mind who you're going to vote for? And what we see is kind of striking differences in as to what issue was most important to that voter in choosing the nominee. So even though, and candidates realize this, and so they take more or less the same positions on issues, right? All these Republican candidates have much more in common with one another than any of them do with Hillary Clinton. But if you go to a town hall meeting in New Hampshire and you listen to their 10-minute stump speech before they take questions, you notice great differences in the issues that they choose to talk about, those three or four issues.
Where's the emphasis?
In those 10 minutes. And that resounds with voters because voters want to hear particular, you know, that people might say, a New Hampshire conservative might say, all right, I understand this is our position on abortion, but I don't want to hear our nominee talk about it all the time for the next 9 months. It's that that's a priority as opposed to a position.
Well, we talked earlier, Dante, about the somewhat conservatives, and that's, again, the group that you say is the one that always picks the winner of the party's nomination and that is the biggest and most evenly distributed around the country. Let's talk about another block that you say, Dante, is, quote, surprisingly strong. That's the moderate to liberal Republicans. Why the word choice, Dante, of surprisingly?
Because the Republicans are identified nowadays as the conservative party, whereas the Democrats are identified as the liberal party. And it's the conservative party that rarely, if ever, nominates very conservative candidates. And what's striking is how moderate and liberal voters have actually had a lot of sway over who the nominee would be.
Moderate to liberal Republican voters.
Yeah. And they're... What's striking is, even in terms of party identification, they're rather ambivalent. Only 6 out of 10 of these voters identify as Republicans as opposed to independents. So here's where we find more independents, relatively fewer Republicans. They clearly dislike the Tea Party. 1 out of 3 express support for the Tea Party. Religion is a marginal thing in their lives. Like they don't go to church as much as other Republicans do. Religion is not a central organizing principle of their lives, let alone their politics. They think abortion should be legal. And in terms of candidate qualities, they like to see candidates with experience, but they also like candidates who says what he or she believes. Like I want someone independent-minded, unafraid to tell it like it is. And that sounds familiar to us. If we think about, say, John McCain,
a straight talk express.
Exactly.
Right.
And we're hearing that this cycle as well. Like there are these straight-talking Republicans who are going to tell us what we need to hear. That sort of thing is a whistle to those moderate voters who are looking for someone independent, mavericky type of Republican.
Who are very important here in the Granite State.
They make up about 1 out of 2. Half the electorate
Wow.
will identify to exit pollers as moderate or liberal.
Well, again, if you're one of those Republican voters or in the other groups Dante talked about, the somewhat conservatives, a little bit later we'll talk about the very conservatives, give us a call. Tell us what you think about this analysis that we're hearing from Dante Scala, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dante, since you mentioned John McCain, again, winner of the New Hampshire primary back in 2000, Arizona senator and then GOP presidential candidate John McCain came on The Exchange during his first race here in New Hampshire, where he sort of blew everybody out of the water, beat George Bush by 17, 18, 19 points. Here he is giving his pitch to that slice of voters that you mentioned, Dante.
I think you should examine my credentials and my experience, but most importantly, you should pay attention, as we are going to in this program, and my vision for the future of the country. I hope that my previous legislative and life experiences would qualify me for your consideration. I believe we need to reform government. I think we need to reform the campaign finance system. I think we need a strong national defense and a coherent national security policy.
Again, that's John McCain speaking on The Exchange back in the 2000 election. So he says it right there, Dante, my credentials and my experience.
Yeah, and he emphasizes reform, including campaign finance reform. Remember back in 2000, John McCain appeared with Democrat presidential candidate Bill Bradley together at a joint forum to talk about campaign finance reform. So McCain was just that example of someone, a candidate who was Republican, but would take positions that would defy the party orthodoxy and cross party lines and so forth. And Lindsey Graham, this cycle, who hangs out with John McCain all the time, is a kind of a latter day example of this. But in 2000, I joke with my co-author, Henry, that our book began with a friendly wager about John McCain, because I remember John McCain goes gangbusters in New Hampshire, wins by double digits.
In 2000.
I'm emailing with my friend Henry, and I say, look, I think John McCain's going to go all the way, and he's going to win the nomination. And Henry said, no, he won't. And I said, no, I'm pretty sure he will. And so about 6 months, a year or so later, we have two seats at Fenway Park. Me and Henry are watching a game. And because I didn't realize at the time how difficult it was going to be for John McCain to build coalitions. And that's the thing. Like the first stage, those first four states, that's where you try to become a champion of one of the faces or one of the factions. But then the harder part, is you have to build coalitions and outreach to other factions of the party for whom you were not the first choice. You might have been the second choice or even the third choice. I mean, that's the thing. We have more than a dozen Republican candidates now, but for a voter, say, in Georgia who votes later, they're going to have maybe three candidates to choose from. So a lot of people are choosing among second best.
That's hard, though, Dante, and I did want to ask you about that. You know, you say for candidates, understanding these four faces means be the champion of your faction. So whether it's, you know, John McCain for the moderates to liberals, or we heard earlier from Bob Dole for the somewhat conservatives, then build your coalition. So it's almost two different tasks.
Mm-hmm.
It's tricky.
And it's especially tricky because sometimes you can, in order to win over your faction, you have to adopt language and rhetoric that makes it more difficult to reach out later to other factions. I mean, take John McCain, for example. He had lots and lots of difficulty reaching out to religious conservatives after New Hampshire. And in fact, at some point, he just swears off the whole thing and goes after Jerry Falwell, and which doesn't play well, as one might guess, in places like South Carolina. But it's this delicate dance to reach out to people and say, I realize I'm not your first choice, but I'm still good enough to be your second choice.
Well, here's an email that came in from Rebecca, who says, in your plan, is Jeb the moderate guy? Thank you, Rebecca, for the email. Since we're talking about this group of Republicans, moderates to liberals, it's a good question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are a number of candidates, Jeb Bush among them, who are trying to emerge from New Hampshire as the the champion of moderate Republican voters. And I think Bush's path to the presidency, to the nomination, has to go through New Hampshire, because he has to win New Hampshire, win over moderate voters, and then hope that he'll get to face off against, say, a Ted Cruz or a Ben Carson. And so in that case, if there's a more moderate Republican versus a religiously conservative or secular conservative candidate, that though, again, the glue, the somewhat conservative voters in the middle might say, you know what, Jeb Bush wasn't my first choice, but if I have to choose between him and someone like Ted Cruz, whom I don't know if I trust how conservative he is, or maybe he's too conservative, I'll go with Jeb. But Bush is in that position, Kasich, Chris Christie. There's a reason why they're camped here and not out in Iowa, where they're all doing poorly and where, not coincidentally, there are a lot of very conservative evangelical voters.
Well, thank you for the email, Rebecca. Again, you can email us at exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Dante, I want to talk about another important group, the group that you call very conservative and religious or evangelical. And to kick off our conversation about this, let's go back to 1996. I feel like we're jumping back in the time machine here. Let's hear from political commentator and Republican presidential candidate Pat Buchanan in the GOP primary debate in Manchester, New Hampshire, in February of 1996.
It speaks up for the right to life of the innocent unborn, whose silent screams often go unheard in this country. It is a new conservatism that speaks up for the working men and women of America, whose jobs are being sent overseas in trade deals, done for the benefit of big transnational corporations that don't care about America anymore. It's a conservatism of the heart that speaks up for middle Americans who are burdened by taxation and who have to see the wives go out and work when they don't want to work. I want to represent in Washington those people that don't have representatives. And that's what this new conservatism is all about, my friends, and it is catching fire. And we're going to take it right to this nomination and into the presidency of the United States.
Well, and Dante Scala, Pat Buchanan did catch fire here in New Hampshire. It was a big upset. Just remind us what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Pat Buchanan won the New Hampshire primary, was endorsed by the Manchester Union leader, and won in a very tight three-way race in which he got fewer than 3 out of 10 votes in the primary, and nonetheless finished first ahead of Bob Dole and Lamar Alexander.
Which is kind of surprising, given that he doesn't fit that moderate to liberal Republican mold here in the Granite State.
Absolutely.
That you talked about.
And people are looking this time and saying, looking at a very fragmented field in New Hampshire and thinking, you know, could a Donald Trump or a Ted Cruz win with a very small plurality?
So, Dante, getting back to Pat Buchanan and that speech we heard there, and again, it's great to hear these clips from the past. He talked about a new conservatism, abortion, family values, wives not having to work if they don't want to, but also the poor and the dispossessed. So that's something interesting you talk about in this book, that the very conservative evangelicals are concerned about, you know, gay marriage and abortion, so-called family values, but also concerned about sort of the downtrodden. Rick Santorum talks about that, too.
Yeah, Mike Huckabee talks about that. I mean, so you find in Buchanan's speech, and I agree, he really sets the tone for the next two decades, you find someone who is socially very conservative. I mean, very conservative evangelical voters don't just want to restrict abortion. They would prefer to prohibit abortion entirely. But you hear from Pat Buchanan, you know, there are kind of shades of Bernie Sanders in there talking about, you know, the power of transnational corporations. I mean, that sounds a bit Sanders-esque.
Yeah, he was very anti-trade, as I remember.
Yeah, and you find that with, you know, Rick Santorum talking about bringing back manufacturing. You hear that in Mike Huckabee. So they're socially conservative, but economically moderate to liberal in their tone, at least. And so this is another interesting split within the Republican Party, is that we have two groups of very conservative voters, the seculars and the evangelicals, but they don't agree amongst themselves on issues like government regulation or intervention in the economy. And so you find a Club for Growth Republican, a secular anti-tax Republican, disliking Mike Huckabee and Pat Buchanan, if by extension, In terms of economic policy and so forth.
Well, since you mentioned Mike Huckabee, let's hear from him as well, because he's been a player before. He's in the race now. Again, former Arkansas governor, 2008 presidential candidate. This is the 2008 Mike Huckabee. Here he is speaking in New Hampshire just ahead of the primary, describing his view of the role of religion in politics.
I believe there is a God. I believe there's a God who is active in the creation process. Now, how did he do it, and when did he do it, and how long did he take? I don't honestly know. And I don't think knowing that would make me a better or a worse president. But I'll tell you what I can tell the country. If they want a president who doesn't believe in God, there's probably plenty of choices. But if I'm selected as president of this country, they'll have one who believes in those words that God did create.
And Dante, you say in your book that a Mike Huckabee-type person talking straight up on the campaign trail about God and his beliefs is anathema to two other groups, the very conservative seculars and the moderate to liberal Republicans.
Right. I mean, the thing to keep in mind about very conservative evangelicals is that religion is a central organizing principle of their lives. Their lives are centered around church. And they're frequent churchgoers, and it's a central organizing principle of their politics. I remember we talked about moderates and liberals, and the quality they wanted to see is someone who speaks their mind. That's not what evangelicals want to hear. They want someone who is, quote unquote, a true conservative. That's their most important thing. Also, someone who shares my values. So they're not moderate liberals, much more kind of pluralistic in that regard. Speak your mind. That's what we want. Evangelicals want someone who shares their same values because they think values are among the most important priorities a president needs to address in the Oval Office.
You mentioned earlier, Dante, be the champion of your faction, then go out and build a coalition. How does a less religious candidate build a coalition with this group?
That is has proven to be difficult again and again in the Republican Party. I mean, we find that with John McCain in 2000. He could not bridge the gap between himself, even though McCain himself, I mean, isn't as if he never talked about religion, but he didn't make a priority of it the way that, say, George W. Bush did when he said during a debate, you know, who's your favorite philosopher? And he said, well, Jesus Christ is my favorite philosopher. I mean, he changed my life and so forth. And if you go to, say, 2008, Mike Huckabee, who said, I come from you, versus Mitt Romney, who took all the right positions on issues, but didn't share the same background faith as those evangelical voters.
More with author and political analyst Dante Scala coming up on the Four Faces of the Republican Party. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the four faces of the Republican Party. In a new book, political scholar Dante Scala and his co-author Henry Olson look at the four factions that have defined the GOP presidential nomination process. It's a process that Scala says is misunderstood and misinterpreted by the media and the so-called conventional wisdom. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. The four faces are the somewhat conservatives, the moderates and liberals, the very conservative and religious, and the very conservative and secular. Dante, let's just finish up talking about the very conservative and religious, and then talk about the very conservative and secular. You write in your book with Henry Olson that this group, the very conservative religious, never wins. They never get the nominee they want.
Yeah, with one exception, perhaps. I mean, well, not quite. It's you go back to 2000. Probably the closest we've seen is George W. Bush. But even in that cycle, there were candidates like, say, Gary Bauer, and Alan Keyes, who were appealing to those very conservative religious voters. But George W. Bush was an acceptable second choice for a lot of those voters once they had to choose between him and John McCain. But if we go forward to 2008, Mike Huckabee won Iowa and survived until the end. But again, given the choice between Mike Huckabee and John McCain, once Mitt Romney dropped out, voters tended to go away from Huckabee. Even the very conservative secular voters were not willing to embrace Huckabee, and they went with John McCain, who they weren't thrilled about either. But again, it was the lesser of two evils. Same in 2012 with, say, Rick Santorum. Again, someone who was unable to build bridges to other parts of the party. And so once again, you have a Mitt Romney versus a Rick Santorum, throw Newt Gingrich in as well. It's been difficult for evangelicals are a tight-knit group and they gather quickly, but their candidates have a hard time reaching out in part because of the positions they take and their priorities. It's interesting how religion splits the so-called religious party, because there are some candidates and one faction that really want religion to be front and center. But there are other Republicans who say, okay, we respect religion, but we don't want that to be such a big part of our politics. It's really difficult for a candidate who's trying to win over the evangelicals to strike the right tone that attracts them but doesn't repel others.
Well, and even though this face or faction, as you write, Dante, doesn't get its preferred nominee, it does play a role in the overall process. It isn't just, you know, forgotten and unimportant.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, Ted Cruz is spending day after day in Iowa, not New Hampshire, because he's trying to do what's rarely been done, which is to unite those very right, very conservative voters, both secular and religious. So he's really trying to defeat both Rand Paul, who we would tend to think of as a who might be attractive to those very conservative secular voters, including libertarians, but he's also trying to defeat Ben Carson. And if he can do both those things early on, then Cruz might be able to build a coalition that we haven't seen too often among those very conservative voters, both secular and religious.
Well, let's talk about the last face of the Republican Party. Last because you say, Dante, it's the smallest, it barely gets any attention, the very conservative, secular, and you describe them as almost entirely inside the Beltway folk. How come?
Well, they tend to be well-educated. They tend to be, and they tend to work in cities, live in cities, and so forth. You take Steve Forbes as an example, a very conservative person who had great wealth, collected art, and including art that was considered controversial by religious conservatives. And so he had a different sort of lifestyle than we might think of as typical for a Republican voter, but clearly one of the elites. And these movement conservatives are concerned first and foremost about things like the Constitution. And
sounds like Rand Paul.
Yeah, the Declaration of Independence and the importance of those things. They respect religion, but it's not a central organizing principle the way it is for evangelicals. They're very strong Republicans, but they're also very enthusiastic about the Tea Party, much more so than somewhat conservatives, let alone moderates and liberals. They care about issues like deficits. You know, if they have to choose.
Like Ross Perot, remember him?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, back in the mid-90s.
Yeah. So you've got a candidate, you know, if you hear a candidate who talks a lot more about budget deficits these days than about the economy in terms of priorities, that's a good signal, perhaps, of a so-called very conservative secular voter.
Well, let's hear a little bit from someone who you say in the book, Dante, perfectly exemplifies this small group, small but influential group of Republicans, the very conservative and secular. Here's Steve Forbes, editor of Forbes magazine, Republican presidential candidate back in the mid-90s in 1996. Here he is making his pitch for smaller government at a GOP primary debate in Manchester, again in 1996. Let's hear.
Some say that a flat tax, that is a tax cut for families, is the main part of my agenda. But it's only part of my agenda. Parents should control education, not the unions. People on Medicare should control their health plans, not the bureaucrats. Young Americans should have their own Social Security system that belongs to them, not the Washington politicians. Politicians may talk about such issues, but I've shown what to do about them. Thank you.
Again, there's Steve Forbes talking about a flat tax, school choice, some measure of privatization of Medicare and Social Security. So that's sort of the pure Cato Institute almost right there.
Right, exactly. And so it's this faction, this face of the party that often has to settle for second best. Remember, we talked earlier about George Bush's ideas about tax cuts and so forth. And Bush was not willing to go as far as Steve Forbes was in terms of radical reforms to the system. But that's exactly what these movement conservatives, very conservative seculars want, someone who's going to completely shake things up. But again, though they're a bit on an island, so to speak. Their candidates tend to falter early. Steve Forbes faltered in not once, but twice in 96, but then again in 2000. And then they have to settle for second best. So they're faced with kind of not terrific choices. Like 2012, are we going to choose between Mitt Romney, with whom we have some issues on things like Romney Care, versus, say, Rick Santorum? You know, and
because these voters are secular, they don't like the religious tones.
Yeah, and that this is our choice. I mean, now we have to choose between this and that, and we're not thrilled, but I guess we'll go with Mitt Romney this time. And same with, in 2000, choose Bush. We don't get Forbes; that was our favorite, but we'll settle for Bush over McCain. So that these people are thought leaders, but they're not influential ultimately when it comes to getting nominees.
Although, just like the very conservative religious voters, Dante, even though they don't often get their first choice, they do have an influence. Once Steve Forbes came out with this flat tax, everybody on the Republican side had to have a flat tax or some version thereof. So that word thought leaders that you used is on target.
Yeah, their ideas, you know, persist beyond their candidacies, to be sure.
Well, and Dante, you know, let's take all this past history and analysis, and this is great, going back again to 1996, and turn it on to the 2016 race. So who is the very conservative and secular candidate this time around, if any?
Well, I think we're
who's the Steve Forbes of 2016?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Rand Paul, I think, would qualify in that bracket, that Rand Paul is hoping, if he's going to turn things around in a place like the Nevada caucuses, where you find a lot of these kind of quasi-libertarians, very conservative, secular voters, in order to get a foothold for the middle and later rounds. But also Ted Cruz, I think, is a candidate to watch who's trying to unite the far right of the party, both seculars and religious. And you hear from
his focus on government and religious values. Go ahead.
Exactly. So I think that's the battle that's taking place on the among those factions. And I think, again, we'll know pretty early whether Ted Cruz can succeed. And Iowa is a key to his entire strategy.
So, Dante, who is, in 2016, that very conservative religious candidate?
Well, we've got several possibilities.
So Cruz, again, is trying to make some inroads there.
Cruz, but you can also throw in there Ben Carson, of course, who has talked about the tax code in terms of tithing, which is a term which has a lot of significance to religious people and has a long history in kind of Judeo-Christian tradition. But also Mike Huckabee is back. Rick Santorum is there. So it's a very crowded lane, to use the kind of popular metaphor this cycle, to try to reach out to those very conservative evangelicals. Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana, was trying to appeal to those voters, and then he eventually gave up and folded up his campaign and went home. But so that's a crowd. But again, Iowa is going to tell us a lot.
They'll crown that faction leader.
Yeah, and if you can't get out of your bracket, so to speak, so it's kind of like an evangelical bracket, and you have to win in order to, you have to survive in order to advance. So often we talk about momentum. A lot of what we're talking about is surviving and not surviving attrition.
Are you applying a March Madness analogy to the Republican presidential primary? Do I hear you doing that, Dante?
Just a little bit.
With so many candidates, it does get complicated.
It does. And candidates realize they have to win over a faction or a bracket of the party in order to advance. You need that base that you can rely on in future contests. And what we find again and again is that, take a Mike Huckabee, he did well among his bracket, among his faction of voters, even when all hope was lost that he would be the nominee. He was still doing very well among very conservative evangelicals because voters form a bond with candidates.
Well, two more faces that we should talk about very quickly. So who would you say, Dante, is the cheerleader or is going to be crowned by the somewhat conservative voters?
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question.
Yeah.
And I think
because everybody's vying for this group since they're so important.
Absolutely. And you can throw in there anywhere from, you know, Christie, Kasich, Jeb Bush are all trying to appeal, you know, from perhaps the more moderate side of things, but to build a outreach to those somewhat conservative voters. But I would say keep an eye in particular on Marco Rubio. I think his candidacy and his whole strategy depends a lot on reaching out to those somewhat conservative voters. And compare him to Ted Cruz, for example. Both advocate change, but Rubio advocates a more moderate type of change, more in line with somewhat conservatives than what Ted Cruz wants.
Well, and very quickly, Dante, you said earlier how important the moderate to liberal Republicans are in this state, almost half of the Republican electorate. But you also say in the book that none of these 2016 candidates are overtly reaching out to these folks.
Right. And probably the closest we get to that is John Kasich, you know, someone who is trying to kind of railing against the crazies in the party and saying, I'm for kind of a sensible type of Republican.
His words, the crazies. Yeah.
His words. And that's loaded as well.
All right. Dante, real interesting. We could talk for another hour. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Dante Scala, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH, a fellow at the Carsey Institute, and co-author of the brand new book, The Four Faces of the Republican Party. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larsen. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.